This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Why We Don't Suck and How All of Us Need to Stop Being Such Partisan Little Bitches. This is the author, Dr. Dennis Leary. There's no room for demons when you're self-possessed. Carrie Fisher. Warning. They have something called sensitive readers now. Publishers hire them to comb through each page of a new manuscript looking for words, phrases, and ideas that are currently deemed politically incorrect and therefore capable of upsetting their delicate lives. Two of them were placed under medical care while trying to finish this book. Author's note. Every fact in this book was Googled and double Googled, then Googled again. Except for the facts that came from my voluminous but sometimes cloudy collection of memories. If you don't believe they happened, you can kiss my Irish ass. This is how I remember them happening. Some names have been changed to protect the innocent. Although I don't know why. Because in the end, just like me, they are all guilty. I should also remind you that I'm a doctor. A real doctor. Of arts and letters. I have the official diploma that says so hanging in my office. There's a photo of it in my first book. How did I become a doctor? I got famous. So my alma mater, Emerson College, from which I actually graduated in 1979, gave me an honorary doctorate many years later when I became a movie star. I made a very funny and extremely short speech, which the kids loved because they were graduating and wanted to go party their asses off. Emerson saved my life, first by giving me a scholarship, which was the only way I could ever afford to attend college, and then by virtue of its teachers, who created an atmosphere that allowed creative students in the arts to thrive. I also met my wife, Anne, there, and we are living happily ever after. Anyway, the point is, I'm a doctor, so I obviously know what the hell I'm talking about, and if I make fun of you in this book, it's for good reason. I also make fun of myself in here, a lot, like a fuck of a lot. So look at the bright side. We both deserve it. Plus, if you sue me, it'll just sell more copies of the book, and even more people will end up reading or listening to whatever it is that's got you in a snit. My prescription? Lighten up and laugh a little. And if you can't manage that, this is really gonna suck for you. Dedicated to my wife, Anne, who is everything. Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. I'm gonna throw these fucking eggs. Dennis Leary, 1971. Shortest opening chapter ever. I was sitting in the Miss Worcester Diner with my dad one day in 1965 when the guy behind the counter delivered my cheeseburger and said to him, John, is there anything you can't do? Some guys who come in here say you're the best mechanic they've ever worked with. Other guys say as a carpenter and electrician, you could pretty much build your own house. On top of which, you play a great accordion, and I hear you were a great goddamn fast man on the Gaelic football field both over in Ireland and right around the corner here in Crompton Park. But if someone asked you to pick one thing and say that's what you are, how would you answer? My dad looked up from his coffee and said, an American. If you're going through hell, keep on going. Winston Churchill. Lead, follow, or get the fuck out of my way. General George S. Patton. Oh, say can you scream. Dear Hillary supporters, what happened? Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania is what happened. Plus a server wiped so clean, it might as well have been a free ad for Bleach Bit. How much do bridal party yoga pants cost? Three fucking states. But look at the bright side. It wasn't the end of the world. Trump was victorious. And one year later, the sky hasn't fallen, the sun still rises, and Cher didn't move to Canada. Plus, Canada's not building a wall to keep us out. Yet. There will be no Trumpageddon or Hillary apology tour. Dear Trump supporters, despite what your hero says, the press is not the enemy of the American people. The real enemy of the American people is butter and politicians who have no sense of humor. Too many of us have turned into chubby fast food junkies who can't take a fucking joke. The president is guilty on both counts. And no matter how many misspelled tweets and blabbermouth declarations he makes, there was no voter fraud or you just inauguration crowd ever seen. Period. and Trump won't be impeached for election ambiguities or for damaging the ozone with a massive carbon footprint comprised mostly of hairspray. It's very simple math. The House of Representatives can't agree on a catered lunch, never mind removing the president. Democrats moan, Republicans groan. Hillary speaks, the president tweets, leaving people like me to ask the really important questions, like, whatever happened to cafefe-flavored cafefe? American politics has always been a clown show, but our latest presidential circus finished as a 50-50 proposition that left this country divided right down the middle. Trump's hyper-patriotic motto, Make America Great Again, resonated with one half of the population. The rest bought into the ultra-bland Hillary for America. They both promised to bring back manufacturing jobs, which will all be done by robots within the next 7 years. And this clowniest of all clown shows ended with no clowning at all. Funny friends I love from both sides of the aisle have lost their minds and all attempts at humor as they rage tweet against Republicans or tweet brag at the Democrats in a nonstop series of social media insult bombs. Hillary and Trump are both infected by the unfunny flu. Now they're coming to get the rest of us, but not on my fucking watch. Hashtag make America laugh again. Fake news. Trump won in a landslide. Alternative fact, Hillary handed him a last-minute squeaker. Trump promised to drain the swamp. He didn't. He just filled it up to overflowing with rich friends and family members, just like Hillary would have done. And each tribe still drenches our electronic devices on a weekly basis, continuing the political turmoil with ridiculous partisan bullshit. Chelsea Clinton tries to tell Republicans at large that she doesn't care about money, after a $3 million wedding to a hedge fund founder. Eric Trump says Democrats aren't even people, unless they play golf on Trump-owned courses, I'm guessing. Because Eric's only real contribution to society so far is knowing the difference between a 9-iron and a lob wedge, and how much to charge you for using both. Hashtag make America golf again. Meanwhile, nothing gets done in D.C. They hold hearings to form committees, to figure out soundbites, to get book deals and fatter lobbying funds. They're not fighting for us. They're fighting for TV time and free filet mignon. And what are the actual voters doing? We're worried about Russian wiretaps on our Chinese phones while driving Japanese cars made in Mexico and sipping Guatemalan lattes topped off with Canadian milk. Hashtag make America anxious again. Trump puts a tanning bed in the Lincoln bedroom. Hillary gets paid for making speeches about why she isn't sleeping there. Well, I'm still trying to decipher exactly what her motto was supposed to mean. Hillary for America? She would have been better off with a more truthful approach. Hey, America, it's my fucking turn. Trump won with 306 Electoral College votes, finishing 45th out of the 58 presidential elections in American history. Now, most high-ranking civil servants would shy away from discussing such pedestrian results and humbly enter office, hoping to change people's minds with 4 years of positive bipartisan action. But not the Donald. He decided to ignore the math and manufacture fantasy figures about my amazing victory and my large electoral college numbers and the biggest mandate ever. Can you really trust this man when he says, I guarantee there's no problem regarding the size of his own penis? Forget Billy Bush and grab him by the pussy. Here's some real locker room talk, okay? Guys with big cocks don't boast about them. They're too busy fucking. Meanwhile, how insane is it that our most recent round of presidential debates devolved into a discussion about the girth and length of a male candidate's genitalia? Let me speak for every guy I know, from both ends of the political spectrum, when I say this in a very bipartisan voice. Ew. And let me publicly record the reaction of every woman I know from age 19 to 90. Ew! If we ever needed proof that it's time for a woman to lead this country, Marco Rubio and Donald Trump provided it live one night on national TV when they both acted like 14-year-old boys at a circle jerk. I'm surprised Carly Fiorina's head didn't explode. Can you imagine her beginning a debate by saying, the education budget is tight and so is my vagina? No. The only recorded instance of Carly discussing her breasts in public was to warn other women about early cancer detection. While Trump and Rubio aimed street corner crotch arrows at each other, Carly was focused on the real issues, whether you agreed with her or not. So clearly one would think much of America was primed for a smart, classy female voice speaking into its most powerful public microphone. And former Secretary of State Clinton seemed to have that bull by the horns. 2 weeks before November 8th, she held what looked like an insurmountable lead, part of which actually held up, because Hillary won the popularity portion of the contest by almost 3 million votes, which is probably how many emails she erased during the course of her campaign. If you're a Hillary fan or an extreme diehard liberal, stop listening to this book right now. It's only going to melt your lefty gossamer wings. Go listen to Elizabeth Warren's new book, I May Look Like Annette Bening, But I'm Really a Native American. It'll teach you how to pay higher taxes while quoting Rosa Parks. If you're a Trump fan or an extreme right-wing conservative, stop listening to this book immediately. That's French for now. Because otherwise, your sanctimonious Second Amendment toes will curl up, and pretty soon you are going to be wicked fucking pissed. That's Boston for angry. Go to the Current Affairs and Politics section of the bookstore, which is where you should find something to soothe your soul. Like the latest edgy Ann Coulter book that might as well be titled Democrats Can Suck My Dick. By the way, I bet Ann's dick is bigger than both Donald's and Hillary's combined. Like her or not, Ann doesn't take shit from anyone. I wish Bill O'Reilly had placed a midnight masturbation call to Coulter. His cock would still be stuck in a no-spin zone. If you're holding a hardcover copy of this book or perusing it on an iPad or your smartphone, it's late 2017 or early 2018 and America remains the greatest country on earth. If you're watching these words fly through the air on the new Apple iGram, their hologram launchpad device, it's 2028, and some of you are probably still flipping out about what a popular vote-drubbing Senator Jon Stewart and Congressman Stephen Colbert just took from President-elect Dwayne Johnson and Vice President Joe Piscopo, even after all those lurid stories broke about Joe banging the Rock's 17-year-old babysitter. But all was seemingly forgiven when Joe did his hilarious throwback Sinatra impression as he guest-hosted SNL the weekend before Election Day. Referencing the May-December relationship during a parody version of My Way, with 22-year-old cast member Suri Jolie Pitt McConaughey Cruz playing the object of his affection, the former New Jersey governor slayed on social media with members of Generation Y's second-wave millennials. In retrospect, it's clear the country was due to go Republican again after 8 years of Elaine Bennis. But the good news is that ex-president Louis Dreyfus will soon return to HBO and star in a half-hour comedy series written and created by her former second-in-command, Vice President Larry David. And even though all he did was play golf for almost two full terms, establishing a probably never-to-be-broken Guinness World Record for most consecutive days playing a sport, 2,837, David deserves our thanks for stepping in to take over after Bernie Sanders went off the rails with his free health care for a former ISIS member's proposal in March 2021. President Rock, whose famed campaign slogan hashtag chisel me in really caught fire, has sworn to uphold his promise to change the spelling of America on day one of his new administration, officially replacing the E with a U. President Trump, who was forced to resign from office after admitting his Trump ties were made by Chinese orphans paid in organic rice balls. You might remember him saying, "This isn't some cheap rice out of an Uncle Ben's box, folks. I hear it's the best tasting rice in the world." Praised President Rock's victory on his hit Trump Network TV show, Big League, Big Hands, while gifting each audience member a free photo of himself and fourth wife, Haley Baldwin. Meanwhile, Melania's controversial 2019 deportation by Donald made news again after New York City Mayor Chelsea Clinton welcomed the ex-First Lady back to the United States during Fashion Week, only to find out that her father, Bill, was accused of groping several models during the show, which stole the media spotlight from the release of Hillary's latest best-selling book, Orange is the New Electoral College, My Prison Epiphanies. Sound ridiculous? Not anymore. What may have played out like political science fiction a scant 12 months ago now seems to be a foreseeable future. This is what happens when Americans have such limited alternatives. Last year, if you asked me the famous, "Who do you want answering the White House phone at 3 o'clock in the morning?" question, my response would have been immediate. Not Bill Clinton, while he's getting blown by another pudgy intern. And no more members of the Bush family, especially ones not named George. What the hell kind of name is Jeb? Sounds like a jar of discount fucking peanut butter. He should have copped that old advertising catchphrase for his campaign motto. Choose the conservatives, choose Jeb. I agree with what David Letterman once said. Bush presidencies are like the Godfather films. You're better off stopping after two. I've had enough of the Clintons and the Bushes. The same faces and arguments for the last three decades. Forget hope and change. What happened to choices? In a country where you can buy 67 different flavors of ice cream, binge watch 435 TV shows, and customize your morning coffee until it's actually just another flavor of ice cream, how is it we only get two political parties to pick from? This year, having blown through $8 bazillion and 16 months of televised screaming, we were left with these two options, an apricot-colored guy who occasionally refers to himself as Ratings Machine DJT, and a woman who must own more pants than Men's Fucking Warehouse. Hillary reminds me of an angry math nun I had in seventh grade, so every time she began bellowing out another stilted speech on TV, my spine would harden like I forgot to do my homework. And whenever she managed to lower her humorless voice to its nurse ratchet register, I turned into Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It just made me want to piss her off even more. Hillary's patronizing, missile of shame launch pad approach often backfired. The basket of deplorables were already supporting Donald, but a lot of undecided voters were turned off by her lecherous indignation. Hard to be smug when you sound like a seagull. That's not sexism, folks. It's nunism. Then she would go on Ellen or Fallon or some other breezy talk show and be charmingly relaxed with a sunshiny smile and a happy disposition. What the fuck? You can count on half of one hand the times Trump has actually laughed out loud in public. Once on Fallon, when Jimmy mussed up the astonishing mound of chemical products that hold his head in place, and once more at the annual Al Smith dinner when Hillary zinged him with some great one-liners. He certainly wasn't smiling when Obama and Seth Meyers peppered him comically at the 2011 White House Correspondents' Dinner. His skin was so thin you could practically see his Big Mac brainstem vowing revenge. It was a joy to observe, like a scientific experiment in pomposity. I love watching Trump deal with descending the stairs of Air Force One. That's a true laugh jackpot. He looks like a timid toddler every single time. Eyes glued to his feet as if he's just downed a stolen bottle of Tia Maria and didn't know he had to exit the aircraft. Watch his process whenever he deplanes. 1. Stand stock still. 2. Quickly wave to whoever the fuck. 3. Stare down and pray. Left foot, right foot, repeat. 4. Eyes down. Don't lean too far forward. We can do this. Each time he reaches ground level, the sense of relief is deafening. Check the Access Hollywood tape. The disgusting misogyny grenade overshadowed his concern about exiting that bus. He stood at the top of the stairs, paused for a moment, and said, "It's always good if you don't fall out of the bus, like Gerald Ford, remember?" Then he took a deep breath, stared down, and began to gingerly move his worried white feet. It's nice to know our tough-talking president will elbow-jab his way to the front of a G7 summit meeting, fire disloyal cabinet members face-to-face, and put down the press in person with an explosive confidence never seen before. As long as there ain't any stairs involved. That's probably why he took the escalator down into the lobby of Trump Tower when announcing his campaign. Staircases are Donald Trump's kryptonite. Hashtag make escalators mandatory. Meanwhile, right from the get-go, I dug his off-the-cuff approach to public speaking. It's like a comedy roller coaster every time he talks, full of spastic, elastic Jim Carrey facial takes and loudmouth meanderings your drunk uncle might spout at a boozed-up summer barbecue. Do I approve of waterboarding? You bet your ass I do. And you can tell them to go fuck themselves. I would bomb the shit out of them. Full disclosure, I've said the exact same stuff without being drunk, but with at least one motherfucker tossed into every sentence. Then again, I'm not the leader of the free world right now. I love watching President Trump boast about how great slash successful slash rich he is, probably because it makes me feel like such a good slash humble slash nice person by comparison. He's called himself smart so many times, even Fredo would throw a red flag. You know who makes Donald Trump look smart? Donald Trump Jr. Stick him in a room with a bowl full of Skittles and some Russian spies, and pretty soon you start to resemble Neil deGrasse Tyson, who might be the only famous person President Trump hasn't insulted yet. He's a bipartisan bulldozer. He's a monster truck ego show, which makes fascinating television. It's like the WWE took over the West Wing. Donald is Hulk Hogan with more hair, no steroids, and no script. Just grab the mic and bloviate. His free association bully pulpit approach becomes a relentless me, myself, and I gasconade. Whenever he puts his unchained id on public display, it bounces from subject to subject faster than an Alzheimer's outpatient. Imagine his set list if he planned it out in advance. Big hands, bad hombres, Schwarzenegger's ratings, build a wall, disgusting Rosie, where's my African American? It's a political car crash you can't look away from. But when you give Donald a printed speech and force him to say it word by word, suddenly he has less charisma than Chuck Schumer's left ball. Hashtag, what the fuck? Listen, if you're not a gifted elocutionist like Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, or Barack Obama, what makes you think reading aloud from a teleprompter is going to make you sound trustworthy? Note to all politicians, it does the exact opposite. You sound like a tight-ass worn-out bag of utter bullshit. Bad. Hillary ain't no saint, and Donald is no day at the beach. He was accused of groping 11 women, handily beating Bill Clinton's count of 8 sexual misconduct allegations. Hillary made big money giving speeches to anyone willing to pay her exorbitant price. Donald bilked students out of hard-earned cash with a fraudulent university. She scrubbed cell phones to hide her sins. He refuses to release the tax forms that contain some of his. But Trump's not a racist. The only color he sees is green. And Hillary's not a socialist. She spent the last 30 years sucking money out of every available marketplace. In the end, they're both just rich old white people trying to grab as much cash as they can. More full disclosure. I voted for Hillary, but I sure as hell didn't want to. She has more baggage than the day before Thanksgiving at LaGuardia Airport. Bernie Sanders seemed like a nice guy, who should be running a Brooklyn arts commune. I dug Larry David's Bernie Sanders on SNL more than Bernie's Bernie Sanders, mostly because Larry looked like he could make it through the first term without using an oxygen tank. I chose Hillary because I don't believe geriatrically religious white dudes should tell women what they can or can't do with their bodies, or that anyone should tell gay people who they can't marry, or a person who might have balls and breasts where they can take a piss. What's the most important word in the phrase transgender American soldier? The middle one, asshole. If there had been a great woman running on the other side, say Anna Navarro or Susan Collins, I would have gladly ticked the Republican box. And I wasn't alone. Tons of us felt like we had to choose between the lesser of two evils. After it was all over, the mainstream media Monday morning quarterbacks talked about how the brash alt-right movement and economically stricken working class proudly brought the Donald into office. But I think part of the reason it came as such a surprise was because of all the quote-unquote leaners out there. Folks who wouldn't declare it out loud the day before the election, but might sidle up to a friend the day after and sheepishly admit, "I voted for Trump." Quite a few of my friends did that. What state is our country in when we end up reluctantly casting our votes for politicians we don't believe in? And if you think Trump's not a politician, try to find one time before this election cycle when he ever mentioned the word Bible or God or faith. Search your memory bank and the internet. Both will come up empty. The closest he ever came to Christ was a Dominican busboy at Mar-a-Lago named Jesus. Not to mention all of the issues he changed colors on over the past 5 years, from abortion to the war in Iraq to tax law, and yes, even Hillary. And if she had won the race, the same public protests and ridiculous D.C. rabble-rousing we've seen for the last 12 months would be taking place in reverse. Instead of the million-woman march with pussycat hats, it would have been the swollen prostates on parade, with free Avodart and lots of extra porta-potties. It's just flip sides of the same ancient political coin. The issues separating them and us can all be negotiated. You want to put a Democratic dent in the Republican armor? Stop stamping your social media feet and start planning to find an electable leader. You want another term of fat cat Trumpian tax cuts? Quit gloating and get ready for a candidate not named Clinton. Democrats are whining about Republican bellyaching while absolutely nothing gets achieved, and our allies try to pull America's head out of its own ample ass. Put the pettiness aside and let the negotiations begin. Like Tom Hagen said, "This is business, sonny, not personal." An approach Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill were savvy enough to take back in the 1980s. Tip was the Democratic Speaker of the House and not afraid to criticize the Republican president. Reagan did the same on a daily basis to his Democratic rival, until 6 o'clock in the evening. Then they'd sit down for a beer or call each other on the phone and figure out what the most important piece of work was for each side that week. And they'd find enough common ground to pass legislation that made both parties happy. After 8 years of Obama fighting Republicans and 12 months of Trump lashing out at Democrats and Republicans alike, it's time to act like Tip and Ron. Otherwise, we are screwed. 2.5 centuries into being the land of the free and the home of the brave, where every citizen has the right to express his or her individual beliefs, a land full of complicated and multicultural tastes and opportunities, we've been broken down into two simplistic opposing teams. Left-wing snowflakes versus right-wing nutjobs. Libertards versus conservadicks. The Clinton News Network versus Fox's Fair and Balanced Republican Report. Every single day it's another circadian dose of dogmatic talking heads caterwauling over each other on CNN and Fox until they get off the air to trade witless factional barbs back and forth during 24-hour Twitter feuds. Sometimes I watch these paid reps from each party yelling into the void, and I'm driven to stand inches away from the TV, shouting back like a madman while I wave two ferocious middle fingers in their vein-popping faces. We're living in an endless echo chamber where everybody's so busy bellowing across the divide they can't hear what the other side has to say. Doomed to forever repeat ourselves. Here's one solitary and true example I happened to stumble upon while watching TV. On the morning of February 22, 2017, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer stood at his podium and claimed the Democrats were manufacturing resistance by training and dispatching protesters to Republican town hall meetings to disrupt conversations about Trump's new health care plan. Fox News ran the press conference live and then gave quick commentary on what bad losers the liberals continued to be. Within minutes, at 11:25 a.m. to be exact, CNN produced footage from August 4, 2009, showing White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs standing at the same podium, claiming Republican Tea Party members were manufacturing resistance by training and dispatching protesters to Democratic town hall meetings in order to disrupt conversation about Obama's new health care plan. CNN had quick commentary on how ironic it all was. Within a few more minutes, at 11:29 a.m. to be just as exact, Fox News ran the Spicer footage, followed by the Gibbs footage, followed by a comment on how ironic it all was. I would have switched back to CNN to see if they'd accuse Fox of plagiarism, but I couldn't because my brain suddenly refused to give a fuck anymore. Jesus. And I'm not referring to the one in charge of cleaning Donald's dishes. Recently, this headline jumped out at my face. Jim bans cable news channels, citing safety concerns. The YMCA gym in Scranton, Pennsylvania had to put a block on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and the Fox Business Channel because bipartisan cardio sessions were leading to partisan fistfights as Democratic Nordic trackers disagreed with Republican treadmill runners. Equipment was being thrown around while people tackled and argued. Total chaos erupted as they screamed and chased each other. At one point, the police had to be called in. First of all, this sounds like an amazing workout. You get a great calorie burn from the chasing, total focus from the arguing, plus heavy lifting combined with kickboxing moves in addition to straining your neck muscles while engaging your physical and emotional core. Let's call it 9 minutes to partisan power abs. My only problem? I'd want to kick every ass in that gym. Why? Because I can't listen to another pile of steaming Republican horse dung while ducking a flock of batshit Democrats anymore. A lifelong Republican friend of mine was clenching his angry jaw recently as he recalled a workplace conversation with a Hillary supporter who was still drenching social media with daily fanatical facts about the election 10 months after it was over. Russia this, white supremacy that, blah, blah, Bannon, yada, yada, Flynn. They screamed back and forth until it reached a boiling point, which is when my buddy got tired of what started to sound like acrimonious personal accusations and stood up for himself. Finally, I had to tell this asshole, he said, "Hey, pal, I got nothing against you people. Some of my best friends are Democrats." My heart sank. Have we really reached the point where an old white guy's civil rights defense from 1962 is being recycled to explain our political situation in 2017? Sad. And I don't mean a Donald Trump overused Twitter-type sad. I mean truly, madly, deeply sad. As in distressingly so. Two Americans who no longer look at each other as fellow citizens, but as enemies from opposing armies, the ruling Republicans versus the dog with a bone Democrats. We've been reduced to and identified as being one or the other with no middle ground, very little wiggle room, and not one worthy alternative. Can you be a gun-toting, God-fearing, pro-life Democrat? Not unless you want your face chewed off by Nancy Pelosi. How about an atheistic, Meryl Streep-loving, Mexican-born Republican? Rudy Giuliani may eat your young. It's all a wall of electronic white noise with no nuance anymore. We're stuck in a self-righteous rut, endlessly bitching about Rachel fucking Maddow or Sean goddamn Hannity, with absolutely no gray area in between. I'm here to say the opposite is true. This country is full of unpredictable people and wonderful contradictions. I'm here to tell you it's time for a new protest movement. Gray Lives Matter. There's a ton of us out here who believe the extreme aspects of both parties are turning sane thinkers into cold outcasts as they lead us off the rails. All you have to do is open your Twitter app at any point in the day to witness a constant storm of blue impeachment tweets and red Republican retorts, as if the only thing social media can provide us is digital agita to incessantly reinforce our differences. Even love isn't safe anymore. 1 in 3 Americans say that clashes over Trump have negatively impacted or ended their relationships. A flurry of so-called Trump divorces have popped up in the court system, each involving implacable problems based on political affiliation. Which, to be fair, means they could also be called Hillary divorces or Bernie breakups. This acrimony has reached all the way into the White House. One Wednesday night last July, newly hired communications director Anthony Scaramucci famously told a reporter, "I'm not Steve Bannon. I'm not trying to suck my own cock." On Thursday morning, Mrs. Scaramucci announced that she was filing for divorce based on her husband's, quote, ruthless quest, unquote, to work for a president that she despises. By Monday afternoon, that president had fired her husband, and the suddenly isolated and lonely mooch was probably asking Bannon for some autofellatio lessons. Once upon a time, because now it actually sounds like a fairy tale, Democratic Party strategist and Bill Clinton supporter James Carville was able to spend his days plotting to defeat President George H.W. Bush in the 1992 election before going home at night to sleep with Bush's campaign manager, Mary Madeline, who happens to still be his wife, and a Trump supporter, along with one of their adult daughters. The other kids sided with their dad and voted for Hillary. They all still love each other and often have passionate political debates at the dinner table, which always end with dessert and hugs. I still remember the days when almost everyone in America got along like the Carville-Madeline clan. Do you? It was only 16 years ago, right after 9/11. As the scent of acrid smoke, orange embers, and gray ash still clung to the cool September air above downtown Manhattan, Americans from all walks of life and each area of the country came in waves to help feed, support, and restore the spirits of New York City's cops and firefighters at Ground Zero. Week after week, as these first responders dug through the twisted steel ruin and melted iron relics, seeking some sign of their fallen comrades, messengers of love poured in to the Big Apple. I met people who had driven overnight from Cincinnati or all day long from Idaho, purely to put in volunteer time any way they could. The only smiles each morning were often due to lifelong New Yorkers meeting fellow Americans from Minnesota or New Mexico, as they bonded over coffee before pitching in to help the city recover. At one point during the October efforts, a firefighter friend of mine said he felt as if he'd met someone from all 50 states, either while working the vaporous pile or taking a little time off to rest and recharge. It was New York's bravest and New York's finest working hand in hand with America's best. I was the lead guest on Letterman's second show after the attacks. And the live audience in the Ed Sullivan Theater was full of compassionate faces from every corner of the country. I'll never forget the tears in Dave's eyes during a break in the taping, so overcome with the shared emotion that was moving everyone in the studio and watching at home. During that awful autumn, New York's grief was felt in each town, hamlet, and metropolis across the nation. America truly felt like one united village. Until Christmas was over. In late January 2002, I fondly recall getting my first Manhattan middle finger in a long time from a taxi driver who also loudly cursed me out as I was crossing 7th Avenue against the light. 4 days after that, President George W. Bush swore revenge upon the axis of evil. 4 weeks after that, native New Yorker Tim Robbins was called a pussy by political pundits for opposing their upcoming Iraq war plans. 4 months later, policeman James Zadroga first suffered breathing problems related to his time at Ground Zero. 4 years further on, and conservatives with presidential hopes were taking pot shots at New York, calling it a nest full of liberal elites as they geared up for the 2008 election. And 4 years after all that, many Republicans, and a few Democrats, finally gave up their stubborn opposition to the Zadroga Act, which promised to compensate the families of first responders whose work at Ground Zero left them dead or dying. What the fuck? .com. It took less than one decade for us to go from a family of bipartisan patriots to a feuding bunch of asinine finger pointers. 8 years of George W. Bush ended with Republican infighting and Tea Party tears. 8 years of Obama finished with politically correct Democrats demanding apologies from edgier liberals who somehow invaded their safe space by expressing an opinion they are far too fragile to hear. Both sides need to grow some balls. We now live in an America so gluten-free that a box of jelly donuts is a bigger threat than Vladimir fucking Putin. Where college kids are more afraid of Ann Coulter than HIV. Where you can tune every one of your digital devices into partisan shows that only say what you wish to hear and won't upset your statin levels. We're becoming political crybabies who climb inside sectarian bubble wrap and suck on our oh-so-sensitive thumbs. I suck down jelly donuts two at a time with a Ted Cruz tome in one hand and an Al Gore atlas in the other, while making fun of each goddamn guy. I'm taking a comic look at what's turned us into the divided states of America, if for no other reason than to help us laugh our asses off about it. And in the true spirit of all our partisan pissing, this book will be an equal opportunity offender, because ultimately we are all to blame for the problems that separate us, and very much together on what makes us not suck. Is a terror attack the only way we can all still come together? I believe we're better than that. We're better than dueling partisan didactics harping their paid way through daily CNN shoutfests. We're better than Fox TV's The Five, where four Republicans maul a Democrat every night in a cloud of Trumpian agitprop. We should be able to rise above such grade school playground bully pulpit bullshit. We could use the Digiverse to unify, but we don't. Last June, Representative Steve Scalise and several others were shot by a crazed Bernie Sanders supporter during a 6:30 a.m. Republican baseball team practice session. Just after 9 a.m., commentators from both CNN and Fox expressed hope that all partisan politics could be put aside for a few days. Those requests came about 2 hours too late. Police had been called to the scene at 7:09 a.m. Dr. Laura sent out her first of 14 tweets blaming Democrats at 8:05 a.m. This joined a river of Democratic tweets blaming Republicans for the lack of gun control laws that had begun rolling around 7:55 a.m. The president patiently stayed away from social media until he was able to visit the hospital that evening and get an update on Scalise's condition, after which he chimed in with a series of special tweets. One pray for Steve, one Russia witch hunt, two crooked Hillarys, and a thank you, Wisconsin. Ironically, we've all become so aware of his social media subject matter that his tweets start to sound like a list of baseball trading cards. By the way, no matter who you voted for, don't fool yourself about our current party icons. They're all in the same business bed together. Hillary and Bill were VIP guests at Donald's wedding to Melania. Donald gave generous donations to Hillary's earlier campaigns and to the Clinton Foundation. Trump used to be a Democrat, voting for and donating to many members of that party. Bill Clinton traveled the chummy charity circuit with George W.'s dad. And Trump defended his now notorious Access Hollywood pussy comments by claiming Bill said much worse things to him when they played golf together. Which I pray to God we get to see again once Donald's out of office. What I wouldn't give to witness Bubba and a tang-toned Trump playing 18 holes with Billy Bush as their caddy. It might sound something like this. Trump, how far would you say this putt is going to break, Billy? Billy Bush, about 9 inches, sir. Trump, so the same length as my dick? Bubba, only if we're using the metric system. Hey, look at that blonde over on the next tee. Billy Bush, she's hot. I'd call her a 9. Trump, great rack, average ass, lousy face. She's maybe a 5 in my book. Would you fuck her, Bill? Bubba, already did. Twice. Billy Bush, you guys are so awesome. Win or lose, they all make money just by being in the game. Hillary's latest book deal was for $6 million. Barack Obama just signed one for 40 million clams. And even though Donald only reads books he supposedly writes about himself, he'll pore over his next one for about 100 grand per ghost-written page. While we're on the subject of books by ex-presidents, can we all agree not to build another useless, empty, and overpriced presidential library? The latest estimates on Obama's planned tribute to himself hovers around a holy shit $1.5 billion. Every single ex-pres feels the need to fund one of these monstrosities with architectural costs approaching a Martian space launch. And for what? Most of them are located in some birthplace outpost called fuck knows where that maybe 15 people visit on any given day. We have finally chosen a non-reader to lead us. Let's use his administration as the dawn of a new, non-academic, incurious, uninterested day. Because Donald's not alone. A recent study of the planet's most literate nations has America in 23rd place. Unless I read it wrong. USA. USA. The fact that you are actually reading, or in this case, listening to something that isn't a tweet, gossip item, or opioid prescription means you deserve a big pat on the back and a better book than this. One written by a real author, with a page-turning plot, clever literary devices, and some deep emotional impact. Sorry to tell you, but you got the wrong Leary. My wife, Anne, writes those kinds of books. I can barely keep track of the keys to my truck, never mind a plot or a theme. But I think we all expect more than that from the chosen few who serve as commander-in-chief and then decide to write about it. We want insight and revealing historical behind-the-scenes data with dollops of diamond-sharp self-reflection. And what do they give us instead? Boring 800-page autobiographies full of blah-blah me and yada-yada you and glibbity-glob God bless America. While the failed candidates they faced write vapid essay collections about political courage and dreams that refuse to die. Excuse me while I puke into a polling booth. If Obama wrote an opus named No, I Couldn't, my money would be plunked down on publication day. I'd read a book by Donald Trump if it was entitled Trophy Wives and Tax Loopholes. But the only Hillary book I'll ever buy is one called It Takes a Hammer and Other Lessons in Destroying Digital Evidence. It's a literary given that the worse presidents perform in office, the more books they write after returning to private life. Jimmy Carter was a total disaster. He literally went on television at the height of the 1979 economic and energy crisis to blame all of us for causing his problems, telling us to stop being so selfish and capitalistic. We responded by showing him the exit sign and electing Ronald Reagan with a true non-alternative fact landslide of 489 electoral votes. Know how many books Carter's written since we chased him back to Georgia? 30, including 3 in 1 year. And not one of them was called What a Self-Righteous Asshole I Was. Nixon barely escaped a prison term after his presidency and instead wrote 8 books, and then a 9th one came out after he died. Like a bony hand in a B-horror movie reaching out of the grave to say, damn right I was a crook, now pay me again, cocksuckers. By comparison, Ronald Reagan wrote 1 book. Bill Clinton wrote 2. And George W. Bush wrote 3. A book about his own presidential decision-making, a biography of his father, and one very touching collection of paintings he made portraying members of the military injured in the line of duty after 9/11, with the proceeds going to help them recover. He's alone in that regard and deserves credit for the effort. Still, if you took the entire ex-pres literary oeuvre and collected into just one of their bloated book museums, you'd be hard-pressed to fill up a single shelf. So what the hell are we building them for? Because they want to see their names engraved on big chunks of steel and stone. And after they die, their minions convince our government to pay further tribute with bridges and highways and airports. Who the hell wants to tie their legacy to places and things we all end up swearing about? Bumper to bumper on the LB goddamn J. Stuck forever inside the Lincoln fucking tunnel. Flight delayed again at JF motherfucking K. You might as well lend your name to the Donald J. Trump Department of Motor Vehicles. Ooh, so tempting. If these guys had any cojones, they'd pony up to the public for posterity. Put your name on a free golf course, getaway spot, or subsidized open bar. Ask a New York City millennial what FDR stands for, and they'll tell you it's the worst way to drive downtown. But if there was an FDR pub with free booze from 10 until closing time, etch him into their minds for eternity. Most teens today discover the story behind Pearl Harbor after drinking one. If Donald leaves office by announcing an annual worldwide Trump Hotel free spa day instead of a library, even Hillary's grandkids will remember him fondly once a year. The Bill Clinton massage parlor, Carly Fiorina facelift center, Obama basketball and bong dispensary, even a Ted Kennedy duck boat booze cruise are guaranteed to make you immortal in the best possible way. If there was a Tip O'Neill tequila, we wouldn't have to explain who he was. People would still be toasting him with margaritas every single day all around the world. Some of you may say I'm debasing the Oval Office, but I'm just telling you how it really is. Most Americans don't give a shit about pretentious books and sacred buildings. But free boob jobs and hand jobs? That's what democracy is all about. The truth is that by virtue of my success, I may now live among what is derisively called America's out-of-touch elite. But I proudly rose up from its hardy immigrant working class. I had a paper route when I was 10 and started washing dishes in a diner at age 13. All of my siblings and many of my cousins also worked there as waitresses, cooks, busboys, and cashiers. I'm a first-generation Irish-American. My parents came to this country by boat. My mom was a maid, and my dad was a mechanic, carpenter, and electrician. Dad considered himself the luckiest man on the face of the earth because even though the closest he got to so-called wealth was painting rich people's houses, he was flush with friends and family, and his kids could go to college by virtue of scholarship money and government-supplied student loans. We were the first O'Learys and O'Sullivans to attend college on either side of the ocean. My mom still lives in the old neighborhood and is a constant lightning rod back to my roots. Even further, full disclosure, I've worked on the sets of television shows with Donald Trump, and he was not only on time and totally prepared, but charming and friendly with every single member of the cast and crew. He also graciously included the Leary Firefighters Foundation as a beneficiary during an episode of The Apprentice. I've hosted a charity event featuring Bill Clinton and had the pleasure of witnessing his ease and powerful abilities as a public speaker. I've met President Obama, been dazzled by his charisma, and sat in on one of his truly hilarious White House correspondents' dinner speeches. I've watched football with Chris Christie, memorialized fallen firefighters with Ted Kennedy, and stood side by side with Prince Charles to raise cash for one of his causes. And I walked away from each and every one of these people even more impressed by my parents. So my take on today's America really comes from their DNA, a healthy dose of humanity crossed with a dash of sarcastic common sense. As a comedian, I'm looking forward to the next 3 years with a possible four more tacked on, and not just because I want to play Kellyanne Conway in the President Trump biopic, which I do. Step aside, Jeffrey Tambor. I can already smell my Golden Globe. I think this country is at a crossroads, and we need to make some changes. We are so entrenched in arguments over individual freedoms, so far apart on which future course we need to choose, and too deeply drawn to the empty fire that fame seems to provide. I'm an expert in that last area, and I have detailed opinions on the previous two. Many of you may beg to differ with me, but you don't have a book deal. So for the next few hours, this is all about what Dr. Dennis Leary prescribes. Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did. She just did it all backwards and in high heels. Ann Richards, former governor of Texas. Madam President. There will be one, very, very soon, shattering the glass ceiling into smithereens. She will come without previous baggage packed to cracking with cash earned through years of making Wall Street speeches for $9 zillion a pop. Without a husband whose sexual track record reaches Caligula levels. Without friends and high places who assure her of a victory so early in the race that she begins to hear only what she wants. She will be funny and loose when the cameras roll and not clinging to a teleprompter as if for dear life. She won't be afraid to express her feminine side while also wielding a tough set of principles. She will not need bleach bit. She won't spend the first 2 hours of each day composing infantile tweets like a hormonal teenager. She will also win without having to belittle her female opponents based on their physical appearance. And in the heated battle of TV debates, her first instinct won't be to attack Megyn Kelly's menstrual cycle or tout the size of her own tits. And she won't have to worry about 15 men coming forward claiming she raped or molested them. But her name will not be Elizabeth Warren or Liz Cheney. They are both successful and media savvy, but also lean far too left-wing moonbat and right-wing conservadouche to gather voters outside those realms. Here are five women who could match Trump in business acumen and easily outwit him on any public stage. Mary Barra, Indra Nooyi, Marilyn Husum, Gina Rometty, and Abigail Johnson, the respective heads of GM, PepsiCo, Lockheed Martin, IBM, and Fidelity Investments, who currently occupy the first five slots on Fortune's list of the most powerful women in America. I'm not telling you which political party they support. On purpose. Because I don't care. Men have been seated in the ultimate position of power in this country for long enough. It's time to turn the reins over. Time for a woman to tell us what we can or can't do with our prostates. Can you imagine how hilarious it would be if our initial female president outlawed Viagra on her first day in office? Think it through. Then every man would know how it feels when women are told what they can or can't do with their vaginas by assholes who don't own one. Our first female POTUS will also spend less time on her physical appearance each morning than our current president apparently does. Who do you want answering that emergency phone call at 3 a.m.? A woman who could jump out of bed and be ready to face the crisis in less than 5 minutes? Or a guy who needs at least another 15 just to reconstruct and lacquer down his hair, not to mention topping off the spray tan? When it comes to being a drama queen, Trump's behavior veers into diva territory more often trod by Patti LuPone. Official White House photographer Sheila Craighead has been ordered to carry around a stool while doing her job so that she can photograph Trump from an elevated position, making him appear taller and slimmer. The last White House occupant to make that same request? Laura Bush. She started the trend by asking Sheila to shoot W from above. And while we're on the subject of looks, any woman would have more decorating sense than the Donald, whose taste runs toward dictator chic. Giant slabs of new gold-flecked marble complemented by heavy gold drapes with gold braiding, hung inside rooms full of fake antique furniture with legs and arms edged in gold. It's a nouveau riche golden blizzard you'd expect to find in the home of a third world monarch, or Elvis Presley. But I digress. The real issue at hand is brains over brawn, touch over touche, cool instead of carried away. Multiple scientific studies have all come to the same conclusions when comparing male and female performance based on genetic ability and statistical data. I'll spare you all the numbers and break it down into easy-to-understand terms. Here are the 10 proven ways women are superior to men. 1. Higher IQ. Women are smarter. Like that's news. 2. Pain tolerance. Google childbirth. End of argument. 3. Memory. My mom remembers everything I ever did wrong. So does my wife. And my daughter. So do yours. 4. Driving. Death by car crash happens to men 77% of the time. And you know who crashes into them? Not women. 5. Negotiating. Women read body language and emotion with 87% more accuracy than men. Men don't know this. Why? Too busy reading Bleacher Report and video game cheat sites. 6. Survival. Women live longer than men by an average of 7 years due to stronger immune systems and less risky behavior. When I asked my 90-year-old mom if we should pull the plug if she ever fell into a coma, she said, "I'll be pulling the plug on you if you don't quit smoking." 7. Investing. The lack of testosterone leads to a much smarter and far less emotional approach to finance, which would seem counterintuitive until you go to Vegas. Think back on the last time you saw a woman at a blackjack table full of drunken losers, cursing their shitty luck and then inexplicably betting again. She was the dealer. 8. Multitasking. Women are capable of focusing on several things at once, like making sandwiches for their children while having a detailed phone conversation about work issues and simultaneously paying the gas bill via iPad. Men, you had us at sandwiches. 9. Empathy. Women have an innate sense of compassion, caring, and kindness toward others. Men ask, who are these others? 10. Computer programming. Not even close. Probably because women spend their time online Googling technical breakthroughs instead of Eskimo porn. Yeah, it exists. And yes, you can see their breath. If Trump screws up, the 2020 race could end with a woman in the Oval Office. If not, 2024 will be the next best option. And if Trump's proven anything with his ascendancy, it's that this announcement could happen at a State of the Union speech in the near future. Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States, Ms. Oprah Winfrey. We're going to sell Jack like soap flakes. JFK's father, Joe Kennedy, 1959. America's got leaders. 7 is a big number for humans. Our skin cells regenerate every 7 days. Our skeletal cells replace themselves every 7 years. Most TV series that go past 7 seasons are deemed to have jumped the shark, and most marriages end in divorce during year 7. And within that 7-year itch is the 4-year fall-off. Psychological studies of romantic relationships show that after 4 years, there is a vast dip in passion and satisfaction, along with extreme boredom and seething anger. Yikes. 67% of couples report that the habits they found endearing at the beginning of the relationship become major turnoffs by year 3. It's kind of amazing, then, that our founding fathers so understood human nature that they had a hunch we should check our presidential love every 4 years. Some historians still claim that a limit of 2 terms was forced onto the presidency by Republicans angered by FDR's 4-term legacy, which included victory over Nazi Germany, Japan, and the Great Depression. But it now stands as a sign of that 7-year itch invading our democracy. We fall in and then out of love, sometimes in 4 years, but definitely in 7. However, these days that cycle has been shredded by our national attention deficit disorder syndrome. I'm calling it NADS. We hand a guy like Obama an economic crisis that would give FDR deja vu, plus 19,000 other major issues we want solved, tell him to get to work, and within a few months stamp our feet, create the sarcastic hashtag thanks Obama, and bitch about not having more cash to spend. We point a flock of network camera trucks at Trump's White House the day he moves in and start calling like tree crows as we criticize his failure to fix health care. It's impossible to stay infatuated with anyone after 18 months of nonstop media exposure on the ever-expanding campaign trail. Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker are already prepping runs for the 2020 Democratic nomination. Does it ever end? NADS or no NADS, we're overexposed. Worry not, my friends. For I have a new cure for this particular political ill. By the way, when Republican Twitter trolls drone on about how they don't want to hear what vain Hollywood celebrities have to say concerning politics, my response is this: too late, you just elected one. It shouldn't be a surprise that in such a narcissistic, social media manic, selfie-obsessed society, we chose to elect a reality TV star to the highest office in the land. It makes perfect sense, given that the average American dedicates 5 hours a day to watching TV. If we break that number 5 down, it becomes even more troubling. Let's say we sleep, or try to, for 8 hours, spend 8 hours at work, and maybe 2 hours getting ready for and traveling to and from our jobs. That leaves us each about 6 hours of free time, 5 of which we spend parked on the couch. Holy diabetes, Batman. And while there were an astounding 455 scripted TV shows to pick from last year, there were also an astonishing 750 reality shows on air. And 70% of us were glued to them for every single episode. It only stands to reason that after investing 1,918 minutes a week watching supposedly real people doing allegedly real things in purportedly real circumstances, reality TV would begin to convince our snack-addled brain cells that some of these morons might be smarter than us. After all, they're on TV and you ain't. Which is a terrifying but true side effect. We are buying into game show level bullshit and trusting the host enough to think that at least one of them can hold public office and solve our country's issues the same way he solved TV problems on a Tuesday night. Donald Trump fires people on NBC, so let's send him to DC to get rid of every greedy fuckwad in this godforsaken government. Let's face it, folks. As far as Trump's concerned, this is a reality show. Video killed the radio star, and now it's coming to eat our politicians. The famous are being swallowed up by the infamous. All bets are off on what qualifies someone to hold the highest office in America. You used to have to run an entire state or a city or become a senator to gain enough experience to aim for the Oval Office. Now you can just run some casinos into the ground, but as long as you used to have a hit show on TV, hey, put your left hand on the Bible and the other one in the air. It's time for at least 4 more seasons. Just as NBC was firing him, the Donald's campaign began to take off, and now he's the host of our ultimate reality TV show, The Celebrity President, a fact that left a lot of liberals condemning our democracy and fearing for our future. But unlike them, I don't think this is the end of hope. As a matter of fact, Donald Trump's victory gave me a bracing blast of newfound faith in the system. Because if his election proved anything, it's that even I could be president one day. Look at his track record. Angry tweets, canceled TV show, thin skin, and an attractive wife. According to that formula, I'm one bad comb over away from living in the White House. Although, you don't want me running America. You think Trump takes too many trips to Mar-a-Lago? I'd be there the entire fucking time. Sitting in the sun, sucking on buttered lobster legs while my minions drop bombs on everybody. Starting with the Yankee Stadium. Hey, if we're going to blur the lines between TV and reality, fuck it. Let's make Kiefer Sutherland the next Democratic nominee. He seems to be able to handle a crisis pretty well on Designated Survivor. Plus, he's also Jack Bauer, so he could personally kick some ISIS ass. It might be time for a reality TV reality check. Donald J. Trump isn't really a billionaire, but he played one on NBC. I played an FDNY firefighter on FX. Do you want me pulling up in a ladder truck when your house is on fire? No. All I'm going to do is curse the flames and light a cigarette off some smoldering debris. Yeah, I know, Donald's a billionaire on paper. But there's something fishy about the lack of published tax returns and the 9 buildings in New York City that peeled his name off their edifices after the election. Turns out, he doesn't actually own the buildings. He was just paid a licensing fee for the use of his name. Here's a little spoiler alert. Actual billionaires don't have time to spend 6 months a year shooting at